Hello, and welcome to Openly Gamer Theater's production of The Stygian Fragment, a Call of Cthulhu roleplay drama.
This is Mike, and I'm playing Father Evan Daniel Leary.
Hello, this is Dan, and I am playing Phineas Lockwood.
This is Brandon. I'll be playing Clarence Rouse.
This is Shannon. I'm playing Julia Margaret Barnes.
This is Jason. I'm playing Jack Houston Smith.
And I'm Sean. I'm playing Robert Lewis Covington.
Be warned, the following content may not be suitable for all audiences.
Rain hammered my car as we pulled up to the 1800 block of Arsenal and parked across the street from a three-story apartment building. Clarence showed me the card with the address of Dorian Daly written on it, 1820. We sat there until we saw the form of Finn Lockwood hastily dive from a taxicab and under an awning that protected the small stoop of the building. Everyone else had made their way across the street and stood next to Finn by the time I had secured my vehicle and made it over there. Clarence held up the card with the address on it. Finn flicked a thumb towards a set of stairs just to the left of the stoop, leading down.
It's a basement apartment, because they give shitty basement apartments letters instead of numbers.
We filed down the steps, Clarence in the lead. Julia pulled a key from her bag and handed it to Rouse, who took it, slipped it into the deadbolt, and smoothly unlocked it with a click. Being the third person in, I bumped into Julia when she stopped short, just inside the door. The reason for her reaction was quickly apparent, as the wave of odor hit me, sour and musty like an animal den. Clarence reached over into the dock and flipped a switch. A loud pop sounded, and the stench of the apartment was briefly replaced with a strong ozone smell. The single light bulb sizzled as it flickered, suspended by a coiled wire from the ceiling, illuminating the single-room apartment of Dorian Daly. Every flat surface moved as the vermin reacted to the sudden shattering of their shadowed safety. Tidiness, it seems, was not a priority of Mr. Daly. Wadded, grimy clothes were strewn on the floor, covering crusted plates of half-eaten food, open tin cans, and what appeared, from a distance, to be a used piss pot, sitting next to a brown-streaked bare mattress. It wasn't Daly's lack of housekeeping skills that caught our attention, though. As jarring as the poor condition of the apartment was, it was the walls. What covered them froze us in our tracks, rendering us speechless. Pictures, newspaper clippings, all pinned up with the manic handwriting scrawled in seemingly random places around them. There were grotesque, disturbing images drawn on scraps of paper. Some looked as if they were begun on the paper and then continued onto the wall where the scrap couldn't contain the artist's dark creation. The most prominent and disturbing was multiple renditions of the toad-like idol in various forms and surrounded by maddening designs. The chaotic nature, the sheer lunacy of the sight, made me very edgy.
When I step in the doorway and I see all this craziness, I draw from under my jacket my 45 automatic.
Kind of archaeologist.
Whoa, whoa! Well, carry travels with a 45 automatic.
Is there a problem?
The kind of archaeologist that's been all over the world.
All right, well, put that thing away before
Africa,
somebody gets hurt.
South America. I've been there.
I start taking pictures of everything.
Julia's camera flashed periodically. Every time it did, it revealed a new maddening detail that slowly faded into darkness as my eyes readjusted to the poorly lit room. and I would begin to focus on something else. Then pop! The effect was quite nauseating. I decided to focus my attention on the pin display, not individually, but as a composition. Many pictographic displays have deeper meaning if seen as a whole. As I stepped back and changed my perspective, it became clear. There were a pair of focal points, an interwoven symmetry that converged on two particular pieces. The first and most obvious was a worn black-on-black card, an invitation, tacked among a swirling design painted on the wall. The tendrils of the pattern acted as links to other works and pieces, like the spiraling branches of some dark tree. The other, much more subtle, was among a grouping of photographs. It was faded, to the point where it was hard to determine exactly what the subject was. Only after a very close inspection could I see that it was a dark, veiled person sitting on a high-backed throne. The pictures around it were of people, taken from afar. Each had a name written on it, identifying who it was. Charles Falstaff, Vivian Falstaff, Thomas Rice, A.G. Grant, Oliver Laclede, Archibald Laclede. Julia stopped taking photos and began looking at the newspaper clippings. As I approached her, she pointed out to me that they were all arranged in chronological order, some with writing accompanying them, like a commentary on the articles themselves. Lockwood turned his attention to the rest of the apartment as we continued to study the wall. I couldn't tell if he was being thorough or was creeped out by the display. I looked at Julia, who was pointing at the photo of the dark-veiled man.
I take a picture of that one. Actually, I'll take it off the wall.
There's your black-veiled prophet.
Well, thanks. Have you seen this man before?
Look at the invitation.
She looked closely at the picture, flicking it with a lacquered nail.
Do either of you who are at the party know this man?
I don't think it exists. It's a figurehead. This guy was crazy.
It's an actual picture.
Look around. This guy was clearly crazy, and he needed an outlet for his problems. And he found this old photograph, and everything just kind of lines up. That's all I'm saying. This guy was crazy.
That doesn't mean we can't glean information from what he's found.
Weren't you at an event where, I don't know how many people were there, but people lived?
Apparently more. It seems like people keep popping up. I don't know.
So it wasn't that bad a thing. Is that what you're saying?
Maybe. Maybe it was. I didn't stick around to find out.
Okay, I'm just going to shrug Mr. Lockwood off, and we can still find something here. And then I'm going to go to, like, the earliest news clippings and see what there is.
I step beside her, reading the articles as she frantically notated the details of each one of them.
March 20th, 1920. Headline, Falstaff heiress dead. Ellis Rice, née Falstaff, 28, took her own life yesterday in her family home. A spokesman for the Falstaff family stated that Mrs. Rice had been suffering from exhaustion and in a fit of hysteria shot herself in the chest with a revolver. The fact that her method of her suicide mirrors that of her father, William Sr., does not seem to be a coincidence.
Whoa.
Doesn't sound like a suicide to me.
No.
The man in my office shot himself in the chest.
In the chest? Who does that?
Crazy people.
Barely legible. Written on the wall beneath it was the word, suicide, with a large question mark. We moved on to the next cluster of articles.
June 22nd, 1920. Headline, Fire Kills Revelers in Cave. A deadly fire tore through the Cherokee Club late last night. Initial reports from the police and fire department state that the number of dead is 20, but admit that the number may rise as they're still in the process of looking for victims. Sources in the police claim that the Cherokee Club, a restaurant located at 421 Cherokee Street, was actually the front for an illegal drinking establishment located at the caves beneath. So far, only two survivors have been recovered, though their names have not been released at this time. December 29th, 1922. Headline, William Falstaff dead. William Falstaff Jr., 41, president of the Falstaff Brewing Company, was accidentally shot late last night in his office. A spokesman for the Falstaff family stated that William was cleaning his revolver when the weapon fired. He was shot in the chest and died instantly. He survived by his wife Vivian and his son William III. February 28, 1925. Headline, Falstaff heir murdered. Louis Falstaff, 35, heir to the Falstaff fortune, was found murdered in his Webster Groves home. Sources claim that Louis was found by his servants. There are speculations that he was tortured prior to his death. A police spokesman states they have several solid leads and they will soon have someone in custody. The Falstaff family declined to comment. March 1st, 1925. Headline, Falstaff murderer shot. Police identified Robert Regan, a vagrant who worked for Louis Falstaff, as the brewery heir's killer. Regan was cornered in an abandoned building near Arsenal Street, where he was shot and taken into custody. Regan is currently at the Alexan Brothers Hospital, where he is being treated for his wounds and being evaluated for insanity. January 18th, 1926. Business Section. Falstaff Mansion to be restored. Charles Falstaff, heir to the Falstaff fortune, has hired a prominent construction firm, Gedecky Brothers, to handle the $1 million project.
I bet that's when that guy got his job.
March 9th, 1927. Obituary. William Channing Webb died at the age of 91. A renowned scholar and professor of anthropology at Princeton University, William is survived by two nephews. Funeral arrangements are pending.
Professor Webb, he was well-respected in our field. He's a well-known anthropologist and an expert on the occult. I know he created some kind of an uproar in the right after the turn of the century about some idol that he found relating to tribes in Greenland.
May 16th, 1927. Headline. Falstaff killer dies in asylum. Robert Regan, convicted of the murder of Louis Falstaff, was killed yesterday during a patient revolt at the St. Louis County Insane Asylum. The cause of the revolt is unknown. Asylum staff state that for no apparent reason, the patient suddenly became increasingly agitated and violent. Several staff members and patients were injured, though Mr. Regan was the only fatality.
The last three entries, the most recent, were circled in red.
June 8, 1927. Headline. Son of National Candy Company kidnapped. Leonard Price Jr., 16, was abducted from the construction site of the National Candy Company's new factory on Gravois.
Who's doing the construction?
Gedecky Brothers.
Oh my god.
They're like in everything. Mm-hmm. How are they getting all these contracts?
June 14th, 1927. Metro section. Baby missing. An infant was taken from her stroller in Lion Park early yesterday afternoon. Sophia Heierberg, the three-month-old daughter of Frederick and Lenore Heierberg, was supervised by the family nanny at the time of the abduction. Police have no leads. June 19, 1927. Metro section. Girl struck by auto identified. Girl killed by a motorist on Broadway yesterday was identified as Maudlin Millen, age 16. Brandon Millen, Maudlin's father and co-owner of Millen & Moore Railroad Supply Company, told reporters that she had been at Lion Park when she got into a spat with her fiancé. Then she ran into traffic and was struck by a motorist. Maudlin's fiancé, Archibald McLeod, was unavailable for comment.
I looked at Julia. She had switched from taking notes and began sketching the wall designs and drawings into her notebook. As she sketched, I looked at a notebook and realized something that I had missed. A repeated element among the tendrils of the centralized pattern. A swirled symbol. The same that was found on the back of the black-on-black invitation that Finn showed us at the Jesuit house. Matching the one tacked here to the wall. The reason that the symbol didn't click with me initially was that it was very understated, almost in the background. But now that it became apparent to me, it stood out in almost everything. A beautifully sublime, seemingly subconscious design. I turned away in time to see Clarence moving toward the door, a hand to his head. He didn't look good, and I decided to leave the others and followed him outside and up the stairs. My concern for his condition was ebbed as I stepped outside and saw him heading to a phone booth on the corner. He stood there, door of the callbacks open, for several moments trying to light a cigarette with a soggy matchbook. I approached and offered him my lighter. He nodded and smiled as he told the operator the number he was trying to reach.
Clarence, what happened to you? I found blood on the floor. The police told me there was a man shot and killed in your office. They wouldn't tell me anything more.
I left you a note.
That barely legible thing. All I could make out was that the blood wasn't yours. You have a lot of explaining to do.
I'm sorry, Betty.
When are you coming in?
Betty, I'm not going to be coming in at all today, no. Unless something pressing is...
Charles Falstaff is in your office.
His face turned white.
That's pressing.
Jack dropped off me and Julie at my office. He and Evan wanted to research a few of the details we'd uncovered, and decided that the university library was the best place to do that. Covington seemed to take an interest in the article about the girl who was recently struck by a motorist, Maudlin Millen. He wanted to see if his uncle's name still had any pull. He went back to his hotel, likely to get freshened up after he was exposed to the filth at Daly's apartment, before making his inquiries. Lockwood? Well, he went off to do whatever it was he did. I didn't ask.
Julia followed me inside and up the stairs, into the outer waiting area where Betty stood, arms crossed, worried look on her face. I gave her my best attempt at a calming smile. She rolled her eyes, clearly irritated at the gesture. I opened the door to my office, and the man inside stood up and looked at Julia and me. Charles Falstaff, richly tailored suit, $20 haircut, one of the richest men in St. Louis, extended his hand out to me. I expected him to be taller.
Mr. Rouse.
Mr. Falstaff. We shook hands. I pretended not to notice him pulling a mop from his coat pocket to wipe his mitt off after touching me.
I'm Julia Barnes. Nice to meet you.
Miss Barnes, it's a pleasure.
She's an acquaintance of mine, thank you.
Thank you for seeing me without an appointment. You were referred to me by Mr. Edwards?
Yeah, that's my brother's partner, a former partner. What can I do for you?
The recommendation was based on Mr. Edwards' assurance that you were an inquiry agent that could work discreetly.
Discreet is my specialty. Can I get you a drink or anything?
Yes. Bourbon, if you have it.
We happen to have some. I'll take some myself. Julia? She gave me a hard look, then opted for discretion rather than to get into a lather. When she came back over to us, Falstaff smiled and took the glass from Julia's hand, taking his seat. I was sweating bullets and tried to mask my nervousness by leaning casually against my desk, sipping my drink.
What I have to say is very sensitive. Recently, I made the decision to renovate my family home. Many years ago, my father converted it into offices for my family's businesses, and it's my intent to change it back. I am currently living in the house while this is taking place, and I've noticed queer happenings that make me believe those whom I hired to do the construction may be far less trustworthy than their reputation implies. In short, it's my belief that they may be conducting illicit activities on my property, and I need you to help me prove it.
Okay, who is it that you hired? Is it,
A very prestigious firm, one that has several lucrative projects all across the city.
What led you to think they're doing something nefarious?
As I said, I live in the house, as well as conduct my own business, and manage my family holdings, and other affairs. I have noticed several odd fellows hanging around, without apparent function. All armed. Heavy equipment and supplies on my property that are very out of place for a home renovation. You have undoubtedly heard of my family. Making fortune and brewing beer puts me under incredible scrutiny from the federal agencies since the start of the Prohibition. If those in my employ are using my property to store or produce illegal alcohol, well, then it's my best interest to stop them. The problem is, the prestige of this company doing the renovations, along with their strong business and political contacts, makes it difficult for me to go to the authorities.
What was the name of the firm?
The Gedeke Brothers.
Oh, I've heard of them. Didn't they have something to do with that boy being kidnapped?
Pardon me?
Oh, no. It was just on a site that they were working on.
Oh.
The boy, the National Candy Company boy. Did you read that in the news?
I do believe I've read that.
Charles blinked at Julia. His refined veneer cracked in confusion. He recovered quickly from his momentary lapse of control, composed himself, then cleared his throat before getting back to the subject.
These strange men lurking about my house, going in and out at all hours of the night.
Have you, has there been any progress made on the renovation of the building?
Oh, sure, the construction is progressing on schedule. It's just strange to me.
Have you voiced your concern with the Gedekes, or...
Initially, yes, I did. And I was told not to worry about it, that everything was in order. It was unspoken, but they were certainly trying to intimidate me.
And then you went to the police?
Oh, no, I want to handle this without police involvement, you see. The Gedekes have very influential friends, connections at City Hall, and the police. This is why I need discretion.
Well, we can do discreet. I'd be more than happy to look into this for you. His whole demeanor lightened as he smiled at me.
As a cover for why you're there, I was thinking of inviting you to the house as guests, hosting a dinner party, where you would spend the night and do your investigation.
That seems like a good cover to me. It seems like have full access.
Absolutely. You would have total access to the house.
Okay.
My intent is not to involve anyone who I have any current connections to. Those who I'm associated with would likely also have links to the Gedekes. Do you know of anyone who is trustworthy, as well as discreet?
I know several people who probably have a vested interest in this that would probably love to come.
Oh, wonderful.
I haven't spoke with them, but...
There is something else. Perhaps you read about it. There was a theft at my house.
I recall that. They said something got stolen from a locked storage unit.
And that was what was reported to the press.
What? Can you share with us what was stolen?
A statuette that has been in my family for years. My brother, Billy, brought it back from one of his many trips abroad.
Does it have more of a sentimental value, or does it have a big monetary value? Why would somebody... Why do you suspect someone would want to take something like this?
I'm not certain. It is a rare antique, but it is the strange details of the theft that trouble me. You see, the security guard that gave his statement to the police was not the same man who I saw guarding the house earlier. In fact, I had never seen this man before.
It sounds like you are saying not only did someone want to take it, but then they wanted to cover that they took it.
That is precisely my suspicion, Miss Barnes. Whomever stole that idol from its storage place did so despite the fact that almost no one knew it existed.
That is interesting.
It was kept in a hidden storage area, among items that are far more enticing to thieves, I assure you.
Who would have known? You said not many people knew that this existed. Who would have known?
Some of the older house staff, perhaps friends of my brother's.
You said your brother brought this home. Do you know where he brought it home from?
Somewhere in Eastern Europe. My brother was a world traveler. As president of the brewery, he frequently traveled abroad. His passion, though, was for ancient history and artifacts. Years before he obtained it, Billy showed me a book with an artist's rendition of the very same statuette. Once he had it, it became one of his most treasured possessions.
What was the book? Do you remember?
Of course I remember, Miss Barnes. Remnants of Lost Empires. I own a copy. It's at the house.
Could I perhaps, at the dinner party, look at this book?
If you wish, you can find it in the library.
So he perhaps hunted down the idol?
More likely, he took advantage of some curio shop owner who didn't realize what he had. Billy was like that.
Yeah, when are you wanting to plan this dinner party?
Tonight.
Tonight? How many guests am I allowed?
Including yourselves, no more than 8. That's all I really have accommodations for.
I like to talk to my associates.
While you are my guest, feel free to roam about at your leisure.
Is there going to be doors locked? Any keys I may need while I'm there?
If you come across any locked doors, find me and I will unlock them.
Okay, thank you.
I do believe these men to be dangerous, though. Please, please take precautions to protect yourselves. I would be beside myself if anyone were to injure themselves on my behalf.
Okay, price just went up a little bit, but...
I understand. Cost is the least of my concerns.
Very well.
I will send a car to pick you up at 7?
I looked at Julie and we shrugged as one. Neither of us wanted to show our excitement over getting access to the mansion, and maybe some answers to our shared questions about the caves beneath. Turning back to Charles, I nodded as he rose. He extended his hand to me again.
Huh. I look forward to this evening.
Mr. Falstaff, pleasure to meet you.
He nodded curtly at Julia.
Miss Barnes.
Pleasure.
We watched him as he closed the door behind him, standing in silence for a long time after he left. It was only well after that I heard Betty say goodbye and close the outer office door that I let out a breath I didn't even know I was holding.
So the non-Falstaff newspaper articles were the candy company kid and the Hairbird baby and the girl. I want to check on the baby and the boy.
Well, I'll go on that.
I had Betty call us a cab, then left instructions for her to inform any of the others, should they call, to meet us at the plaza at 6. I wanted to meet up well before Charles's car arrived so we could compare notes and hunches prior to the dinner party at the Falstaff Mansion.
From the Journal of Robert L. Covington, M.D., June 22, 1927. After witnessing the truly disturbing sight that was Dorian Daly's living quarters, I decided to branch out on my own and follow up on the case of Maudlin Millen. According to the newspaper article we found on Daly's wall, Millen was struck and killed by an automobile just 4 days prior. I took a chance and called the county coroner's office. the very same office once held by my uncle, Daniel.
Coroner's office, Bain speaking.
Hello, this is Robert Covington. I'm looking into an accident here in the past. A maudlin Millen.
Millen, maudlin. Ah, yes. How can I help you?
I'd like to know if I could swing by and take a look.
Robert Covington. Any relation to Daniel Covington?
Yes, that is my uncle.
Oh. Well, I can notify the morgue and meet you there in 30 minutes?
That's fine. I shortly arrived and was promptly escorted to the morgue by an orderly. Dr. Kenneth Baines, the man who succeeded my uncle, was a very taciturn, businesslike man. Very professional. As I entered, he met me at the door and shook my hand.
Doctor, I was a friend of your uncle's.
He never mentioned you. Nice to meet you, though, Kenneth.
Right this way. I took the liberty of setting up the body for viewing. I also had a copy of the official autopsy as well as the police report brought down from records. I hope that was all right.
Yeah, they said that she was seen arguing with her boyfriend, Laclede.
I believe so. The police report was very thorough. The officer should have signed the bottom. Yes, here. Officer Terrence McGee.
What are they saying is the cause of death? I took the report from him and scanned it as he moved to the table and uncovered the body, reciting the report word for word as I read it.
Cause of death? Intracranial hemorrhage from blunt force impact to the occipital skull, resulting in depressed fracture at point of impact and internally perforation of the posterior temporal artery. Head trauma is consistent with sudden striking of pavement after a short burst of acceleration. Other major wounds from the accident are compound mid-shaft humerus fracture, compound distal tibia fracture, multiple rib fractures resulting in laceration of the diaphragm, also consistent with striking the pavement.
Hmm. He stood on the opposite side of the table and looked up at me.
Here is where the logical injuries end, and the rest are truly bizarre. And I might add, not mentioned in the official autopsy report filed with the county.
He pointed a thin, tapered finger at several wounds on the subject. Ones not indicated on the paper I held.
I labeled these wounds as well as my other findings in my original report.
Okay, go ahead and make a medicine roll.
47. It became quickly apparent to me that the paperwork in my hand was incomplete, missing data.
But as you have no doubt noticed, the page detailing them is missing. I realized that myself when the record was brought down. Luckily, I keep a copy of all my reports in my personal files. They're in my office. So while you continue your examination, I'll go retrieve my copy.
Yes, I would like to see all the paperwork on this. Who does the filing?
The county records clerk, but once filed, anyone with proper credentials could have accessed it. I'll be back momentarily.
Okay. Moments later, he returned with a duplicate of the original submitted report. This one with two pages. The first discrepancy I noticed was the presence of several abrasions to the wrist and ankles, not listed in the report filed with the county. Wounds consistent with being tightly bound with a cord or rope. So no one looked into this, huh?
No.
Baines then drew my attention to her left hand, where she was missing flanges 4 and 5, cleanly shorn just above the metacarpus.
I estimate that her fingers were removed a week before her death.
Huh, a week before. In the report that I've read, it says that she was arguing with her boyfriend before. Would that have been that time?
In public, that is very unlikely.
Who was the sergeant in charge of this case?
Officer McGee.
Yeah.
St. Louis Police filed it under accidental death.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to them later today.
One other oddity before you go.
Baines reached over, grabbing the subject by the shoulder and waist, turning her towards himself, giving me full view of the dorsum. My breath caught in my throat. A swirled pattern was branded into the skin on her back, one matching the pattern found on the back of the black-on-black invitation, and all over the apartment of Dorian Daly. I stepped back in horror. Not since the days as a field surgeon from the Second Army had I seen a body in such an abused state. That was war. This was a 16-year-old girl.
Someone bound this girl. cut off her fingers, strangled her, likely to the point of unconsciousness, several times, burnt her skin with a brand.
Do you think this girl was tortured?
Yes, Doctor. She was. All the city was concerned with was the cause of death. None of these other details mattered.
I definitely need to talk to this sergeant.
I can help with that.
Did she have any effects on her at all? Any possessions? Anything in her pockets?
Not really. A clutch purse with makeup bag, keys. Not much else. Anyway, I will call the precinct and make sure McGee is there when you arrive. I can also have an orderly arrange a taxicab for you.
Yes, please. I spent a few more minutes going over the complete report while Baines arranged my ride to the precinct. When I arrived at the South Precinct, the desk sergeant pointed me to the direction of the office of Captain Thomas, Officer McGee's CO. As I approached, Thomas was waiting for me just outside his office with McGee.
Dr. Covington, I'm Captain Thomas. Dr. Baines, the coroner physician, told me that you were coming and why.
He turned, indicating the young man behind him.
This is Officer McGee. You can use my office.
McGee turned and went into the office.
I'm sorry about your uncle.
Oh, thank you. You knew him?
We all did. He was very well respected. This city suffered a great loss when he died.
Thomas waited for me to enter the office before shutting the door, leaving me alone with McGee. The kid looked all of 20 years old and scared out of his mind. It wasn't clear to me if I made him nervous or thought that he was just in trouble.
How can I help you, Doctor?
I'm looking into the Maudlin Millen case that you were on.
Yes, sir.
Well, the report filed, there's a second page missing to the actual report that was filed. Explain that. He looked at me for a moment in genuine confusion.
If anything is missing, you'd have to check the city clerk's office.
He thought to himself for a time and then looked at me.
If there are any specifics that you need, I remember it pretty clearly.
Yeah, I was just at the coroner's office, and me and Dr. Baines, he was helping me go through some things, and he's got the actual report that he did, and it's not with the same as the one that was filed. He's got a whole second page to it, and there's a lot of abuse to this body that's not been reported.
Hmm. Well, she was in pretty bad shape when I came on the scene. I was walking my beat on Broadway near Lyon Park, when I heard a car break heavily and a scream. When I arrived, the motorist had gotten out and Miss Millen was laying on the street.
So you were there before she died?
No, sir. Not really. I was walking my beat.
Oh.
The motorist stated that she didn't see Miss Millen until it was too late. She said it appeared that Miss Millen was running from something.
I can believe that. She was abused.
I don't know anything about that, sir, but she was hurt pretty badly when I arrived. If she was abused prior to the accident, I couldn't tell. There was a lot of blood.
There was evidence of bruising and two missing fingers, not to mention the burn on her back.
I don't know anything about that, sir. I rode with her in the back of the motorist vehicle, but she died before we could get to Alexei and Brothers.
Did she tell you anything?
Well, yeah, she did. She didn't make much sense.
I mean, what was her last dying words?
It was weird. She kept on talking about some boy and a baby. Find the boy and the baby.
But you didn't. She was alone when you found her. Nobody was there trying to help her. Nobody.
Besides the motorist and myself? No. No one.
Did you look into this boy and baby?
No, sir. I was told not to read too much into it. She was likely referring to her beau and her unborn baby.
She was pregnant?
That's what I was told, sir.
Hmm.
I took a statement from the fiancé, Archibald Laclede, who stated that they had a disagreement. She became emotional and ran into traffic.
Hmm, that's very odd. And the report had nothing in it of her being pregnant at all or ever having children?
You're talking about the autopsy report? No.
I hope that I've been a help, sir.
It's left me very confused. I want to call Kenneth Baines up again.
Morgue.
Kenneth Baines.
Speaking.
Yeah, this is Dr. Covington again.
Oh, yes.
On your autopsy, did you find anything that she had had a baby or had a miscarriage or anything like that?
No.
She wasn't pregnant or anything?
No. Miss Millen's maidenhead was intact.
Hmm. All right. Just more dead ends.
Let me know if I can be of any more help.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope that you have enjoyed this episode of the Stygian Fragment. Please check for further episodes posted on our website, gamerstable.com. Theme music by Thomas Grillo. Background music by Musica Cthuliana. Openly Gamer Theater would like to thank H.P. Lovecraft for giving us Cthulhu. Any commercial use of this production is prohibited. Call of Cthulhu role-playing game is property of Chaosium Incorporated. Openly Gamer Theater is trademark property of Side Tangent Productions.